Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
What day is today, Marjorie?
Today's Wednesday, Jim.
What day does it feel like?
It feels like Tuesday.
Exactly. But it is Wednesday. And why? I'm continuing with the theme. Why does it feel like Tuesday?
Because it's a four-day
exactly.
work week. And you were taking advice from one of our guests yesterday and looking on the bright side, looking at those little happy moments, Jim, to kind of, you know, change your sour disposition.
She said you should write down three things. I could only come up with one. But I'm going to keep working it. You know, yesterday, Marjorie, the bromance continued. Again, they met on the Jersey Shore. They went for a stroll. They played carnival games. One won a prize, a teddy bear for the other. The strange beach fellows, as the New York Times called them, Chris Christie and Barack Obama. We want your reaction to this bipartisan love fest, as Marjorie called it. Is it betrayal, as many Romneyites saw it in October of last year, or as many New Jersey Democrats now see it with the gubernatorial election around the corner, or is it the best of what politics should be? I mean, civil, outcome-oriented, for the people. Our number is 877-301-8970. You know that I am as cynical as the day is long, and then some. Every time I see Christie, who is sort of a mad dog Republican in many ways. He's the attack dog. That's why he was picked to be the keynote speaker at Romney's Republican National Convention. Whenever I see Obama and Christie together, I say to myself, this is what it's supposed to be. Two guys who have totally different worldviews who actually, in this one moment, and now a second moment, come together. It's just, it's terrific. I love every second of
it. Well, I think that's a lot of people's big complaint, is that things have gotten so nasty down in Washington, D.C. I mean, we've heard all these stories before, how, you know, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan would have a scotch together or whatever they drank after battling it out on the...
Chris Matthews, who was at Suffolk when I was there the other day to get my thing, he said that is all Irish stereotyping. They never had a drink together.
They did not.
They were friendly. They got along in a very civil way. But this whole Friday end of work week, because he worked for Tip O'Neill.
But that is a legendary story that they had a drink together after work. And Hatch, who didn't drink, I guess, because he's a Mormon, and Ted Kennedy, they were very close too. Orrin Hatch being the Republican, of course,
from
and
Utah.
Ted Kennedy, the liberal lion.
Edgar, our colleague, Sam Ervin and Howard Baker, remember the Democrat and the Republican on one of the highest profile issues in recent American politics during the Watergate era, Pat Moynihan and Bob Dole. I love this. We want to know, which camp are you in? Are you in the Marjorie and Jim camp, who celebrates this kind of thing and say, this should be a role model for how American politics should be, not all the time, but a lot of the time? Or are you a Republican who, again, still hasn't gotten over the fact that Chris Christie may have given Barack Obama the bump he needed in October to be elected in November? And by the way, this, I don't even know what the woman's name is. I think her name is Bruno, some state senator who is running against Chris Christie in the gubernatorial election. She is out of her mind.
She
angry.
Did nothing.
She is saying he denies climate change. It's outrageous. She obviously can't, meaning Chris Christie, who she's running against. But when the beloved Democratic president of the United States, and I say beloved because in Democratic states like Jersey and Massachusetts, his numbers are through the roof, meaning Barack Obama's, when he literally and figuratively embraces the Republican governor, it doesn't do much for the Democratic candidate. What was the greatest moment from yesterday, Marjorie?
The athletic
Explain.
Goof up.
Explain. Was that goof
Barack
up?
Obama,
it was,
once again.
It was beautiful.
Well, they were doing, I mean, Barack Obama was trying to win a teddy bear, and he kind of did a reenactment of the Viagra ad or the Cialis ad, whatever it is, when you try to throw the football through the tire.
Yeah, it's in Point Pleasant on the boardwalk there in New Jersey. What was
strolling.
His record? How did he do?
Well, I think he took four times.
Five.
Was it five times?
How many times did he do it?
He did it five times.
Zero. I mean, how many times did he hit?
He didn't get it through. He didn't get it through the tire, and it was a one and done for Chris Christie. He just throws the football. Was it the football they
football,
threw?
Football, yeah.
Threw once through the tire, and it went right through. And, you know, Barack Obama's had a bad history with these athletic events. Remember when he played, was bowling and during the campaign?
Yeah, he scored like a 68 or something.
I think
but
he
by the way, the end of that story, we should just say, is when Christie, on his first attempt, after Obama fails five in a row, throws the football through the tire, he says the president can pick, and the president picks a teddy bear in a Chicago Bears football sweatshirt. 877-301-8970. What's your reaction to this? You know, Marjorie said to me this morning, she said, what's the issue here? She said, who would not look like glowingly on this rare moment of bipartisan warmth between two high-profile leaders of their parties? And the answer is, at least, I don't know how many people outside of New Jersey on the Democratic side are upset about it, but if you're a Romney supporter, you don't think in October you were out of your mind. Many people think if Christie runs for president in 2016 and does not win the presidential nomination of his party, it is specifically because of his embrace of Barack Obama.
Well, Stephen doesn't think it's such a great idea.
What did he say?
He has a news update. He just emailed this. He said they had a falling out last night. Eric Holder told Obama that Christie had been trading emails with Rush Limbaugh.
Exactly. Incidentally, our email where that went was bpr@wgbh.org. Here's Chris Christie on MSNBC. This is last year, obviously, after Sandy hit.
What I say at the time was I was asked about how was the president doing, and I said he's doing a good job. He's kept his word. We saw suffering together. And when you see that, you're either going to step up and be responsible or you're not. And we stepped up and we're responsible together. And since that time, I have to say, everything that they promised they would do, they've done. And so I don't have any complaints or arguments with them this morning on the issue of Sandy relief.
And it has continued for months and months. And again, shortly after he leaves Moore, Oklahoma, in his role as consoler-in-chief, the president travels to the Jersey Shore. And if you haven't seen the images of the two of them again, there's real warmth. I'm serious. You see the smile on the faces, the warmth in the handshakes. Mm-hmm. They're playing this carnival game with the football thing. And again, I am not a sappy soul. I am more cynic than sap. But it says to me, why can't a little piece of American politics be like this, like Kennedy and Hatch, like O'Neill and Reagan? Why can't that happen?
Because the extreme left and the extreme right are totally polarized, and your side is just as bad as the other side. If you're a member of the extreme right, you want to see the extreme left as evil, bad people, and the extreme left wants to take it. Takes the same view of the extreme right.
But excuse me, many people believe that Barack Obama represents that left, and many people believe that Chris Christie, as evidenced by his selection as keynote speaker.
I don't know who thinks Barack Obama represents the extreme left.
A lot of conservatives in this country do.
Well, then they don't look too closely. Why
did Chris Christie get chosen as keynote speaker at the Republican convention? Because he's a moderate? Because he's a conciliator? No, because he could do the best job of eviscerating the Democratic candidate, Barack Obama.
What he did, which could be not a good thing for his prospects in 2016, he spent the whole speech talking about himself.
Yeah, he did. 877-301-8970. What was your reaction to the images? And what was your reaction? You know, it's one of these things where it's amazing that Obama agreed to do the football thing again, because it wasn't just when he got the, what did he get, a 68 when he was bowling, as you said?
I thought it was like a 27.
He threw out the first pitch at a Washington Nationals game in 2010 or 9 or something like
2010.
That. And it bounced halfway to home plate.
George Bush actually got it over the...
right after 9/11.
Got it over the mound.
Strike.
Thank God.
Speaking of strike, by the way, and this has nothing to do with this, Jeff Bowman, who lost both his legs in the marathon, and Carlos Arredondo, who was with us a couple of months ago, who rescued him, the guy in the cowboy hat, they both threw out the first pitch last night, one to David Ortiz, one to the catcher, Salta Lamacchia, both threw perfect strikes. I mean, is that... How great is that, by the way?
Do you know the Boy Scouts had a big debate last week
in Dallas? Yeah,
you wrote about it. They were going to allow gay scouts and gay scout leaders. They didn't actually vote on the gay scout leaders, but they did vote on the gay scouts, and it passed 60-40. I interviewed one of your buddies, Marshall Sloan, who's
founder
of Century
Bank.
He's
a great, great person.
He's 87 years old. Yeah. He's not the kind of the typical older guy that would be as liberal as he is on these kind of issues. And he talked about how over 3 days they had about 50 people get up and speak at this Boy Scout convention in Texas, and it's a very emotional issue.
Of course.
He said no matter what people's positions were, at the end of what their little statements, everybody got a hand, got applause. And he was talking about an example that you rarely see in our politics. Well, that people that vehemently disagree on something as emotional as this, he said, we're all Boy Scouts. That's why we did it. You know, we respect each other and all that kind of stuff. But he said our politicians should take a lesson that these people can feel so upset and an issue involving their children and involving people's religion, et cetera, and be civil to the other side was a great example. And he's right.
I agree. It was a beautiful thing. 877-301-8970. We're talking about yesterday's, I guess, renewal of the bromance between Barack Obama and the governor of New Jersey, Republican Chris Christie. And want your thoughts as to whether or not you see it as a great betrayal, as like a lot of partisan activists do, or as you see, if you see it as Marjorie and I do, is this great, rare example of bipartisanship that's actually focused on outcomes and people as opposed to rigid ideology. Let's start New Hampshire with Joe. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Joe.
How you doing?
Excellent.
Great. Well, you know, I thought, honestly, by seeing it on TV and watching it, that it was sincere. And I thought it was fantastic to see two parties get along like that. I've never seen it before in my life. And I just think that other people in both parties should take this and look at it and say, hey, We can get more accomplished if we get along like this.
Are you a Republican or a Democrat, Joe?
I'm in between. I'm right down the middle. I take it for what it is.
Were you a Romneyite or an Obamaite in November last year?
Romney.
And were you upset by the fact that a lot of people who voted for Romney, supported Romney, thought that that Chris Christie's behavior post-Sandy with the president helped give the president the bump he needed to win the election?
Not at all, because he needed that. That was help that they needed.
I agree.
And, you know, you have your differences and you have your squirrels, but you know something? If you need something, you really got to work together and get it done.
Joe, every word you said is a word I embrace. Joe, thank you kindly for the call.
But you know something? Obama is lousy at this, too. I mean, he does not exactly go out and schmooze with his Republican counterparts.
You ever read The Hill? The Hill is this newspaper, essentially, that covers Capitol Hill. They do a story about how – you remember, did you read the stories in March, I think it was, where Obama was inviting all these Republican senators to the White House for dinner to begin that sort of schmooze fest mm-hmm. that gets things done? You know what all the Republican senators are saying now?
What?
They haven't heard a word from him since the dinner. They're all saying how great it was, and now, as you suggest, he doesn't do the follow-up.
And he made a joke at the White House Correspondents' Dinner about how horrible it would be to have a drink with Mitch McConnell. I mean, that wasn't exactly, you know, a bipartisan.
What are you saying? Would you want to have a drink with
him? Exactly.
Speaking of jokes at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Conan O'Brien joked about Governor Christie at that dinner, and it relates to our topic. Listen to what Conan had to say.
Also, I'd like to acknowledge that earlier this evening, there was some confusion with the seating chart. For a moment, someone accidentally sat Governor Chris Christie with the Republicans. That was awkward, and I apologize.
877, not much laughter, 301-8970. We're celebrating, and we want to know if you're celebrating along with us, this rare moment of bipartisanship last October, and again yesterday on the New Jersey shore. Judy, you're in Arlington. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey.
Hey, I am a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, but I am a Jersey Shore girl,
Oof.
And I have to say, I don't feel Jersey is very Democratic, but that's okay. I'm living in the Boston area, so mm-hmm. by comparison. But I am with your last caller. I am so happy to see bipartisanship. I'm old enough to remember that there used to be some bipartisanship, and it's gotten so polarized that this is only a good thing. And I just think it has to happen. I think other people should take a page from this book, and I agree.
I was just going to say there was a great piece. The Globe was running it from time to time, talking about a broken city, about Washington, D.C. being broken. And they had a piece yesterday. I think the guy's name was Congressman Nolan, who'd been gone for 32 years. And he came back to represent his district yet again. And he talked about exactly that 30 years ago, they had a baseball team or some kind of sporting team called the Knee Jerk Liberals that went out, you know, against the right wing nuts or something like that. And they played ball together and they went out for beers afterwards or whatever, and how it's you hardly talk in the halls anymore. And also, the other great point he made is that nobody stays in the district anymore. People used to bring their families and live there. Now they're all flying out of there on Thursday afternoons to come back home to Arkansas or, you know, New Mexico or Massachusetts or wherever they live.
Judy, well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can I just say one more thing, though, is when you look back in the past, the numbers of most far right or far left was a much smaller percentage than it is today, and I think the right has much more far right or more great in number than the far left because of that pledge that they take, blah-de-blah. You know, a lot of people go in and say, like Scott Brown did, you know, well, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and then you get hamstrung. He makes a few conciliatory actions, but really, they still follow a lot more of the party line.
Well, you know, I was with you until the Scott Brown thing. We've had this debate a million times. Scott Brown was actually the critical vote on a lot of things, including, speaking of liberal Democrats, Barney Frank and Chris Dodd's financial services reform. The vote that put it over the top, even though he demanded compromises, was Brown's. Hey, Judy, thank you so much for the call.
Jim.
What?
We know why you feel that way.
Well, I know. You're going to say it's not a bromance. Hey, I know
him. Jim and Scott Brown, they reached across the ideological aisle to have a bromance.
Okay,
it was legendary. And every once in a while, I see this, you know,
okay,
this
Marjorie.
Smile come across Jim's face and a little redness moving up his neck, a little blush going on. And I say, another text. From Senator Brown.
Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. By the way, Kristen Quincy had to hang up. He called. He called to say that Obama is the bromancer in chief, which he should. You know, I've told you the story before. I lobbied in Washington in the 80s for a little while, and it was because Ronald Reagan proposed the abolition of legal services for the poor. I was a legal services lawyer. I was president of the union that represented legal services people. The two champions legislatively to save the program, Barney Frank, a freshman, and Ted Kennedy, obviously not a freshman. I've told you the story. I remember the day we met with Ted Kennedy for the first time, I was scared out of my mind. Oh, my God, Ted Kennedy. He talks about a strategy, how to deal with this, how he has to reach across the aisle. I mention that there was this horrible right-wing Republican from Texas who hated the program. He says, let me deal with him. The next day, I'm walking through the halls of the Senate. I see a figure in the distance walking arm in arm with another figure in the distance. And when I approached, you know who it was?
The right wing.
It was Ted Kennedy walking down the hall, arm in arm, with a very conservative senator from Texas.
But,
it's like unbelievable.
But how many people are able to do that? I
very
guess that's
few.
My point.
Very few.
I mean, I'm sure you would not touch that right wing person. That
well, it happens not
services.
To be true. That's not true at all. I'm into results. I am not into ideological purity.
Oh, please.
You know what Barack
you hated
Obama
Ronald
says?
Reagan.
I didn't hate Ronald Reagan
yes, you
at
did.
All.
Yes, you did. There's only one reason why you had the bromance with Scott Brown.
Okay, fine.
Look at Ronald Reagan. You look at
okay,
Scott
fine.
Brown. I think we have our answer.
Maybe we do. Maybe we don't. Eric here in New Bedford. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking about the special relationship, which both of us love, between Chris Christie and Barack Obama. Hey, Eric.
How you doing?
Excellent.
I think that it's I think it's not really a bad thing. I'm not 30 years old yet, and the majority of the politics that I've been exposed to growing up has been this kind of divisive and polarizing kind of stuff that
yep.
we see all the time. You know, I was in high school during the GW years and all that, and I'm just like, I'm looking at this with Barack Obama and Chris Christie, and I'm thinking, this is great, but this is not a pattern that I have ever seen emerge in politics. And so I personally would be hesitant to embrace it as something deeper. I think it's great on the offset, just the fact that we can see these two leaders getting along and just making friendly with one another and not hurling, you know, just insults back and forth. But I'm hesitant to be convinced that this might lead to greater things just because I have not seen it really established as a pattern.
Well, let me tell you one place where you may see it on one of the most divisive issues in American politics, at least so far through the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republicans and Democrats are doing the same sort of dance on immigration reform. And if you had said 6 months ago, what's the issue they're least likely, maybe other than gun control, to work together in a cooperative fashion, it's that. If that makes it through the Senate and ultimately makes its way through the House to the president, you'll get to see an example that, by the way, Marjorie and I are a little older than you, and we haven't seen it much in recent years, but maybe the immigration debate changes it. Eric, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, I repeat, the left is just as bad as the right. There are,
oh,
litmus,
totally.
There are litmus tests on the right. There are litmus tests on the left.
Let's go to
and
Nancy.
The ones on the left are coming from you, Jim.
The Nancy in Worcester, you are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey there.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
So I think that this is an election strategy for Chris Christie. I think he's trying to show that he's a Republican who can work with Democrats.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a lot of people are still feeling burned from the Bush administration with, you know, all the shenanigans that went on with that. And I think his recent weight loss surgery is also part of the whole, you know, the preparing for the 2016 election.
You know, Nancy, I'm so glad you pointed that out. If people don't know, he did have that lap band surgery. And one of these Republican analysts was quoted, I think it was either in the Times piece, the New Yorker piece, I forget where it was. But he said, charisma and a good lap band story beat any perfectly articulated policy position in 2016. Because how many people, Nancy, in America that are dealing with weight issues can relate to his battle with his weight?
Well, it's also
absolutely.
He's got kids, as he said. But, Nancy, let me play the place I disagree with you. Is, and this is not an original thought, you have to win a primary to get to the final. And while I think there's no question that images of Christie with Barack Obama would be hugely helpful to Christie in a final, should he be the Republican nominee, everybody knows the old maxim, far right Republicans vote in Republican primaries, far left Democrats vote in Democratic primaries. So the issue is, can his relationship with Obama unravel? Will it unravel his presidential hopes in his own party? And that's where I think he's got the hurdle. But Nancy, thank you for the call, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very
much. What are you looking at me for?
I was just looking at you to see if you were
talking. I'm done. I've said everything I need to say and then some.
Remember, we went on to a fascinating topic from a Nova documentary, tracking down the Tsarnaev brothers. How did technology work in that quest? How did it fail? Journalist Miles O'Brien is going to join us to talk about that. It's his Nova documentary, which looks at these issues. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Spring into the summer with the WGBH Spring Auction. Time is running out to bid on some fantastic deals like electronics, jewelry, vacation getaways, and more.
Even a brand new Toyota Prius, donated by your New England Toyota dealers.
And every winning bid supports the programs you love.
And be sure to tune in for the live TV auction June 2nd on WGBH2.
Bid high
and bid often
at auction.wgbh.org.
We love our contributors. That means you and Mass Eye and Ear. When ear, nose, and throat problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. And Zoomix, presenting its 2013 Jazz at the Firehouse Concert Series, featuring the Kenny Hadley Big Band, Sunday, June 2nd at 5 p.m. More at zoomix.org. That's Zumix.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. Manhunt, Boston Bombers, the NOVA documentary, airs tonight at 9 o'clock on WGBH Channel 2. It examines the intersection of technology with old-fashioned detective work in tracking down the Marathon Bombers. It shows how far we've come, and I guess how far we still have to go. The man behind Manhunt, the reporter and the producer, joins us in Studio 3. Great to see you, Miles O'Brien.
Good to be here, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey, Miles, congratulations on a great job.
It's great.
In this documentary. It's spectacular. So what's the answer? Did technology beat out good old-fashioned police work in capturing the Tsarnaev brothers or not?
A little bit of both. A little bit of both. You know, it's interesting. We talk so much about video and facial recognition.
Yep.
And those of us who like to go to the movies think, you know, click, 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 CSI, and boom, we got a match, and they go and get the guy. But it doesn't work out that way. When you think about those pictures, when they were finally released, and how fuzzy they were, and how few pixels there were between the eyeballs, so to speak, the task for the FBI and the investigators to try to find a match, to run those images against a database of driver's licenses or passport photos, was just too much. But we found a researcher in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon University who's pushing the technology such that computers with artificial intelligence, machine learning, can take those 6 or 12 pixels and create what he calls a hallucination of a face. And yet it works. It actually works.
Yeah, but now, wait a minute. I did see one guy, and maybe this is not the same guy, that did have the kind of fuzzy picture of the younger brother, Johar. And then they did all the computer stuff.
That's him.
Okay. It wound up with some weird-looking face that looked like a woman to me, with a face that was fat and looked nothing like him.
Well, that's the interesting thing. It looked like a dud to me, too.
Yeah.
And so what he did was, he was going to give that image to the FBI to see if it would work. Of course, events overtook him, and Johar Tsarnaev was identified. That allowed him to run an experiment, because then he had a good high-resolution picture of Johar. He put it into a database with a million other mug shots. Mm-hmm. And put this thing that looks to me and you not like him at all.
Right.
And it was a hit. It actually, when you filtered out for only males and whites and no facial hair, it was number 20 out of a million. Number 20 out of a million. That's amazing. And it doesn't look like him.
It
really doesn't.
Nothing like him.
But to the computer, the geometry of the face was enough of a match that it found it.
You know, we had the pleasure of seeing this thing in advance. You'll watch it tonight at 9. It deals with experts on bomb analysis, this facial recognition, a whole variety of things. The misspelling of the older Tsarnaev brother's name, we'll get to that in a minute. The thing, Miles O'Brien, that I was just obsessed with, everybody watched that Thursday night press conference when the head of the FBI, DeLaurier, here released the photos. We saw the videos, that sort of stuff. And then you tell the story behind the scenes about how the cops had to go store by store, camera by camera, to collect all these videos, and you butt that up against the something called the Domain Awareness System in New York City, the only one of its kind. Say what had to happen here and then describe what New York City does.
Well, the videos are all basically owned by the landlords. You know, there are a few public cameras, of course, for traffic and so forth. But generally, Boston police, they don't have a nerve center with a bunch of cameras, as we all envision, once again, from the movie. So literally within 10 minutes, Ed Davis had one of his detectives walking down store by store to Boylston saying, hey, can we use your video? And that you can imagine how cumbersome this is and how much this slows down an investigation to have to do that. They compiled all the video, and then, of course, people started giving them video on top of that. And so they were down at the Black Falcon cruise terminal in a warehouse down there with 20 computers trying to sort through all this thing. Well, when you think about the time that it took to do all that and compare that to what we saw in New York with this domain awareness system, where they have now 4,000 cameras, mostly privately owned, soon to be 6,000, feeding into one room in real time. Now, the problem when you do that is, how do you possibly drink from that fire hose? And so they partnered with Microsoft, and they have this software which literally predicts and detects suspicious behavior. So if somebody puts a bag down on a sidewalk, the computer watches it, and whatever the increment of time is, it flags it. And so the people in the center, all of a sudden there's a camera that comes up and says, you better check out this bag over there near the New York Stock Exchange. It's extraordinary, and it's scary.
You know, and by the way, what was really scary is there was a woman you interviewed who's like 11 years old who's running this thing. But putting that aside,
Jessica Tisch,
that's
of the Tisch family.
It's is that a, so?
Those are all her buildings she's worried about. Yeah.
But you know what was amazing?
And family real estate.
Yes,
correct
yes.
me if I got this wrong. We're talking to Miles O'Brien, by the way, the man behind this manhunt, Boston Bombers, right? Is that what it is? Boston Bombers tonight at 9 o'clock on Channel 2. I think it also said with that domain awareness system, they take a picture of every license plate coming in and out of New York, and it is immediately by computer matched up with a terrorist watch list. I mean, this is like 31st century kind of stuff. It's unbelievable.
You know, I lived in New York, and I had no idea the extent of that, that every time you go through the tunnel, they're checking out that license
every
plate.
License
every
plate.
Single plate that comes in and out of that city. And of course in Manhattan you have the advantage of these choke points where you can do that, right? And so that, I mean, the surveillance state that we have created post 9/11 is something I don't think that we have fully reckoned with, and we're headed down a slippery slope here. We really are. I mean, this technology is tremendous, and if you had that real-time center in Boston on that day, that might have helped authorities make an arrest.
Do we not
well,
have
hold
it?
Hold on. That is the bottom line.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Well, I was just going to
ask. Ahead, sure.
I mean, you're the reporter. You're the producer. You've looked at this extensively to produce this manhunt that's going to air tonight. So what do you think? Is it worth it, that this giving up our privacy? If we could have prevented some deaths had they captured the Tsarnaevs earlier.
I think we have got to be very careful that we don't create a place that is safe and we don't want to live in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of where we're headed. Now, you know, using cameras on sidewalks on a daily basis, that doesn't bother me so much. But if the next year's marathon, everybody has to go in through a metal detector to go watch the race, we've gone too far. So and if that camera is watching us as we go inside our private domains, that's where we're headed.
But you just said you lived in New York for years and had no idea that you were being watched all the time. So part of me thinks it's like the tree falling in the forest and no one hears it. If you don't realize this is going on, you're just going about your business, you're not killing anybody, you're not blowing anybody up, there's not going to be a reason to look at Miles' trail of where he's been. And that's the argument from the other side, saying, we have no idea we're being watched all the time. What difference does it make?
If you have nothing to hide, why should you worry
about
this? That's what they say.
Because freedom is a nice thing. That's one of the reasons.
And this is eventually, though, these things, you know, what happens is we build the infrastructure, we build the apparatus, we build the bureaucracies to manage these things, and inevitably the power grows. And that's what I don't think we're there yet, but I just think it's something we should be aware of.
But I don't know if you're implying that, Miles O'Brien, that the reason why we don't have like these domain awareness centers in lots of communities is because of these deep concerns for civil liberties. The cameras are all there.
No.
It's because I assume because they can't afford to have one of these nerve centers. You can't,
New York has got the money.
Exactly. And that's what the bottom line. You know, one other thing, I was so fascinated by this. In addition to this license plate thing, wasn't there a moment in your documentary where they punch up, show me everybody who's wearing red clothing at all of these major points in the city, and they hit a button.
Within 2 seconds.
And
Jim.
Everybody wearing red clothing in these key. I mean, again, I am wildly against a lot of this surveillance stuff, but if you have it, then you should be able to manage it, and New York City can really do it.
All right, so just imagine for a moment on April 15th, if they had the white cap as a key. Mm-hmm. They could have used that software.
This is the thing that the younger brother was wearing backwards on his head. Yeah.
They knew very quickly about the white cap guy. Using that software, they could have pulled up a network of cameras and would have had a picture that much sooner. And as you well know, were it not for a whole series of circumstances, people probably would have been killed in New York, given the way this whole thing was unfolding. And so time really was of the essence. And, you know, if it weren't for Danny, the guy who got carjacked and was bravely and cleverly got away, who knows where this would have headed? So technology could have made it not necessary for that to have happened.
But you also just said, and Miles O'Brien, we want to tell you again why Miles O'Brien is here, because his documentary Manhunt on the Boston Bombers is going to air tonight at 9 on WGBH. You did say before that they're so sophisticated in New York that they could have spotted a backpack and alerted people about the backpack. So again, I think some people would say, gee, if you have that level of sophistication, maybe that's what we need, because what we're hearing post the Boston bombers, post this atrocity over in Great Britain, is that these lone wolf or double wolves together, kind of small attacks which cause a lot of damage, is the new face of terrorism.
Well, you know, we got to be careful about the signal to noise ratio here, though. If you had those cameras and you had thousands of people at the finish line and you're looking for a backpack, it may not have provided enough useful information. It might have been too much information, and you have to sort through all that.
But they had the bomb-sniffing dogs there. The German shepherds were there.
Yeah. It's interesting because I was asking repeatedly in the course of the manhunt in Watertown, why didn't the dogs pick up a scent? Maybe it's a failure of dog technology. I don't know.
Well, you know, also, you know, taking things too far, and you mentioned this in your documentary too, Miles O'Brien, is we all remember the Reddit fiasco where this crowdsourcing thing, citizens became crime solvers, except they didn't. They named that poor kid from Brown, whose body was ultimately found, and they said he may have been involved. Those two guys, I'll never forget the image on the cover of the New York Post, who obviously had nothing to do with anything, but became essentially enemies number one and two. So there's a limit to this. Stuff is dangerous in the wrong hands.
Let's talk about one other aspect of technology. You focused in, too, on the final scene where the authorities closed in on Johar in the boat. Of course, we know the citizen alerted the cops that they thought Johar might be out there. But talk about the technology used on him in the boat.
It was that, you know, it's an infrared camera, which, you know, widely used by police departments. But in this case, it really was the perfect application of technology at that moment. There was every reason to believe he was in the boat. There was a lot of evidence. And obviously, the homeowner, you know, saw the trail of blood. And so the police would have been there anyway. But what a useful thing to be able to peer through that, you know, shrink wrap, that opaque shrink wrap, and see with a heat signature, a camera that measures your heat as opposed to the visual spectrum, to be able to see him lying there, clearly injured. It was quite evident from that. And that gave them a lot of information about how to approach the situation. So it was just one more way that, you know, the technology and the old-fashioned shoe leather kind of came together in this one.
Well, can we talk about where it failed for a moment so we don't have this love
fest?
Yeah,
that's important. Let's do that.
This is from the documentary. In 2011, everybody knows, the FBI added Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older brother, to a terrorist watch list. But his name was misspelled. His birthday was wrong. In 2012, when he returned to the U.S. after a six-month trip, he was not flagged for another FBI interview. You interviewed this guy, Victor Meyer Schoenberg. He's a professor at the Oxford Internet Institute. He explained what went wrong.
The problem then was that the U.S. Law enforcement agencies reacted in a small data spirit, in a small data mindset, by using the exact name and trying to find an exact match in the database. And because the name was misspelled, they didn't find an exact match. Google actually has the ability to do messy big data analysis that can deal with misspelled words, and law enforcement can't. If law enforcement had used a Google-style big data analysis, chances are that they might have prevented Boston bombing from happening.
So when you hear that, and if you're one of the families who either lost somebody or has a person you love with missing a leg or two, what kind of reaction do you have that there was a misspelling? Google could have handled it, but the federal government couldn't?
You know, it's really the most poignant moment of the hour to my way of thinking.
I agree with you.
Here you have a list that we keep of 800,000 people, this so-called TIDE list. This is not the no-fly list, but this is the watch list, and he was on it. But, you know, the transliteration of Cyrillic made it not a perfect match. Well, that if you're going to manage a list like that and not manage it properly and use it in a smart way, what's the point of having it? And I mean, really, is it too unwieldy? Obviously, the technology is there. There's a couple things to think about. We're still dealing with a bunch of agencies that don't talk to each other, even all these years after they talked about stovepiping after 9/11. And there's one other thing which the expert pointed out there. the best minds in this, the ones who really understand big data and how to use it, they don't work in law enforcement. We need to lure some of these smart people. As policing moves into this era, we have to find a way to lure the best and the brightest to be a part of it, because you have to think in a big data way, but that means you have to be properly schooled in it as well.
So a couple of weeks ago, we were talking to Dana Priest from the Washington Post. We agreed the head of Visa should be head of the CIA, and apparently Google should be head of the national security apparatus for the United States.
It's exactly the point, isn't it?
So what's the one takeaway at the end of the hour when people are watching this? What do they leave with Miles O'Brien?
Well, you know, you guys know Superintendent Billy Evans. He's just,
he is so skinny. He's run like 25 marathons.
He ran his 44th marathon.
Yeah,
and that was his 44th that day.
Wow.
And 90 minutes later, he's down there directing his troops. And he's such a great guy. And he's everything I love about Boston is embodied in that guy.
And body fat at all.
Zero body fat. So, you know, the takeaway from him is it's important. You know, I cover technology and science. It's easy to say, oh, if we had this, this, and this, it'd all be solved. It's not. It's still issue leather. It's still guys on the ground picking up those tiny pieces. It's still guys walking down the street, you know, getting the videos in. Human beings still solve crimes.
Good.
I love that.
I'm glad to know that.
And still do talk radio and still report and produce great documentaries.
Job security is what I'm after, right?
Miles, you did great work on this thing. People got to see it. It's great.
And Miles O'Brien is the reporter and producer of the Nova documentary, Manhunt Boston Bombers. It airs tonight at 9 on WGBH. Congratulations again, Miles. It was absolutely fantastic. And WGBH, of course, is Channel 2. Okay. The state's welfare agency made millions of dollars in payments to people who are dead. We're going to talk to the woman who's been tracking these numbers for over 2 years, that state auditor, Suzanne Bump. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. The Herald page one headline says it all. There's a picture of a tombstone. This is, again, the front page of the Boston Herald. Superimposed are the words "rip off," but "rip" is R-I-P off, and it's obviously the story of the dead collecting welfare in Massachusetts. The woman who generated the headline and led the investigation that led to the story is the auditor in Massachusetts, Suzanne Bump, and she joins us on the phone. Auditor Bump, thanks so much for your time.
I'm delighted to be talking to you both.
I'm issuing a lot of congratulations today. I just told congratulations to Miles O'Brien, this great documentary, Manhunt, tonight. And congratulations to you, Auditor Bump, for finding out about this rather disgraceful operation over at the Department of Transitional Assistance. Tell people what is going on with these 1,100 dead people.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about this. This comes after over a year of our looking at the operations of the DTA with regard to their determinations of eligibility and continued eligibility and controls that they have in place to make sure that the benefits that people receive through EBT cards are not being abused. And what we found that led to a number of specific findings was that DTA was not checking the Social Security numbers that people used to apply for benefits. It also, and so therefore, people were receiving benefits that perhaps were not entitled to them. They weren't who they claimed to be. We also found that when we did a match-up of the Social Security list of deceased persons with the list of DTA recipients, that there were indeed 1,164 cases where benefits not just were being provided, but were being used by people who appeared to be dead. They were listed as being dead. We found that guardians were claiming dependents who, again, were listed as being deceased. We found that there were multiple people receiving
benefits under two separate security numbers, social security numbers, and that there were multiple security numbers, social security numbers being used by multiple people.
Can we stay, let's stay, Suzanne Bum, let's stay on the dead people for a second here. What? Go ahead, Margaret.
Also, Auditor, you just said that the department was not checking people's social security numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't make a move without somebody checking your social security number.
It's very reminiscent of an audit that we put out a couple of months ago of the Mass Health program, where we found that people could present information as to where they lived, and that wasn't being checked, or how much self-reported income they had. You know, that was often an IRS W-2 form. They weren't checking on that either. They were just taking people at their word.
So why don't they? Why don't they do the cross checking? Is it because they don't want to, or don't care, or because they don't have the staff, the person power? What's the argument on their side why they don't do what you think they should do?
Well, you know, when we run these kinds of system checks, sometimes ask, don't ask. They acknowledged when we were doing this that they. That they could have been doing a better job, and that they assured us, going to do a better job. So they took, we said, okay, you've got this new method now of doing this. We went back and we checked part of the group of 1,164 deceased persons that we identified, just did a sample of them, ran it through their new and improved system, and we still found that 67% of them still had active accounts.
Can I ask you a question about that before you go ahead, Auditor Bump? One thing I wasn't clear about, Adrian Walker in his column this morning in the Globe essentially prints the response indirectly of Stacey Monaghan, who's the interim commissioner. She says they got a sample from you of 178 of these alleged dead collectors of things, and 79% of them were alive. So I want to understand the math. So is it really probably only 600 of those 1,100 who are actually dead, or is the 1,100 after you've sorted through the living and the dead?
Well, I have got to actually tell you that there's even a question of apples and oranges there, because the 178 people that they did their match on weren't from this 1,164.
Oh, they weren't?
No. See, and that's...
those are more dead people that we had to list.
That's the number... That's the 178.
This is awful.
Was under the category of questionable dependent claims. There were 178 guardians claiming a dependent.
Can I tell you something? The one most incredible thing to me is not the dead thing, even though that is frightening. There was one person who you audited, who's not named, who received 127 EBT cards. Allegedly, I mean, I assume the allegation on the part of that recipient is that they lost the 127. Is that correct?
Apparently.
Even though I am generally somebody who errs on the side of privacy, if a state senator who voted last week against putting a photograph on an EBT card were to be in front of you today and read that thing about the 127 duplicate cards, what would that conversation? What would you say to that person as the fix for the 127?
Well, actually, apart from the audit, the department saw a lot of this coming and knew that it was in some trouble some months ago. They instituted a process now for requiring people to show up in order to get another card, and also to pay for replacement cards.
How much?
I think it's only $5, but the impact. I was just listening to an interview with HHS Secretary John Polanowicz yesterday, and he said that it's already resulted in something like a 60% reduction in people coming in requesting multiple cards.
But wait a second. But even though that sounds great, if you had a picture on a card, correct me if I'm wrong, then if you happen to be somebody to whom an EBT card was illegally sold, if someone looks at the photograph and you're not that person, they're not going to let you use the card, right?
Well, you know, there are a couple of factors, Jim, that impact the practicality of that suggestion.
What are they?
So one is that the EBT card, particularly when you're talking about food stamps get issued to a family. You might send your teenage son to the store to pick up something. Should he not be able to buy a loaf of bread or bottled milk.
Well, that's actually a great point in light of the fact that a huge percentage of people getting food stamps, despite the popular misconception, are actually low-income workers who are doing that. That's a very good, that's a very good point.
You know, and then because you can cash in, if you will, your benefit through an ATM, you could, you know, anybody could do that. So that the card, the presence or absence of a photo isn't going to change that dynamic at all. And so I do appreciate how they the agency said, look, we've done a cost ratio benefit ratio. It's going to cost a lot of money, and it's not going to have the kind of deterrent effect that you hope.
But let's get the big picture here. There needs to be a deterrent effect because, as you guys pointed out, in 6 years, DTA reissued 147,000 replacement cards, an average of 9,000 people. That averages 14 new cards per person, which is just outrageous, which leads you to believe that people are doing not what they're supposed to be doing with these EBT cards. A few months ago, the Herald, and I'll give the Boston Herald the credit with this, all credit, because they unearthed it, that the department is spending $25 million on people who aren't even eligible to have these cards, and they couldn't locate thousands of recipients. So I guess the point is, Auditor Bump, we are wasting millions and millions and millions of dollars in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and you don't. Everybody wants people that are eligible and are poor and are going through difficult times to get the money. But what we're doing is sending off money to people that are living in the Virgin Islands.
Yeah, it is really unfortunate, going to your first point, that the agency had not been, and I hope they have a 100-day plan in. I know that they're committed to it. It addresses many of the things in this audit. That they just hadn't prioritized, though, fraud fighting. Not at the inception of the benefits, not on an ongoing basis. They weren't using the tools at their disposal. All of those things that we found out about how cards could be abused, all this suspicious activity around cards, you know, that all of the benefits would be downloaded in one store at one time in an even dollar amount, all of that kind of stuff. They could have been doing those kinds of reports, identifying patterns of suspicious activity and in doing further investigation themselves, and they weren't making use of those tools.
Yeah, so, one last question for me, Auditor Bump, if I can, is what I think this work is really important, and it's critical for people to have trust in government to believe their tax money's being spent well. But on the flip side, the so-called dead recipients, what was it, $2 million, $2.3 or $4 over 2 years, so it's $1 million a year. Does the legislature? You're a former legislator.
Right.
Does the legislature spend any time on looking at the recipients of hundreds of millions, actually billions of dollars, for example, in corporate tax breaks, as opposed to welfare recipients who are sort of easy marks? And I'm not criticizing your work, by the way. I'm criticizing, I guess, the reaction. When a welfare recipient gets a check or a card they're not entitled to, it's sort of like call out the National Guard. But does the legislature ever look? Do you ever look at this spending on corporations, which in many ways dwarfs this spending?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I have been trying to help focus their attention on that. A couple of years ago, my first year in office, we did a review of corporate tax breaks, found that there were about $2 billion worth of them given out or allowed on an annual basis. There were no measures of success for over $1 billion worth of them. It led to some recommendations that I hope that the legislature will seriously consider about periodic review of these programs. We have been trying, and led me to file legislation because I tried to audit how effectively the Department of Revenue was actually auditing the use of business tax breaks, and I couldn't do my audit because in order to do so, I'd have to look at individual corporate tax returns. I'm not allowed to under the law. I'm seeking legislative permission to do that.
So, but the bottom line answer to my question, to put words in your mouth, is they are more concerned about a welfare recipient getting a card they're not entitled to than a big corporation getting a multi-million dollar tax break. Is that a fair statement?
in my experience.
Thank
that
you.
There has been a greater reaction.
Great. Auditor Bump, great report. We really appreciate your time. Suzanne Bump, who obviously came out with this report on not just dead welfare recipients, but others yesterday. Suzanne Bump, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, Jim and Marjorie.
We're
going to
spend
you.
A couple of minutes with you guys at 877-301-8970. 2 million. By the way, let me be clear before my position is misrepresented. Mm-hmm. This is really it's significant because any dollar misspent that's then advertised on the front page of the Globe or the Herald destroys the trust that people have in government. So I'm not saying it's insignificant. It's $1 million a year on these dead people getting benefits that then go to a friend or relative who is stealing them. How much is this much ado about not much? At the same time, that Auditor Bump just acknowledged, it was the same legislature that will track to the end of the world a welfare recipient who steals $500, doesn't give a you-know-what about major corporations when they give them tens of millions of dollars.
I think you can walk and chew gum at the same time.
But they don't.
Well, they should. They should do a lot of things. But I think you always overlook your ilk over there, the perniciousness of this system. You don't – it's not a good way to live, to be dependent.
It's horrible. I agree.
That's right. And so the government has to be – and there are people that need it for a lot of reasons. They've lost their jobs or they're disabled or whatever it is. But it's really difficult when people who are playing by the rules, who are struggling, who are working two jobs and three jobs and can't get their kid into a good daycare and can't get into a good school and can't afford to move to a nice neighborhood, are looking at their next door neighbors stealing on a daily basis. And that's why this is very important.
Well, you know,
really
I'll give you a concrete example of why, to extend your point. The response when Deval Patrick won $1 billion for early education and $1 billion for transportation was, well, stop giving welfare benefits to people. They didn't say dead people then, people who aren't entitled to it, and you can use that money.
Exactly.
So the answer is,
it was at least $50 million in waste
I agree,
a year.
But do you acknowledge, if I'm willing to acknowledge that without any problem, that there's a double standard? If you're a big business that pals around with the people on Beacon Hill, no one checks, as the Auditor Bump acknowledged, whether those tens of million dollars in tax breaks are spent on anything constructive. But if an EBT card is sold
to
somebody.
Why do you think the legislature is less anxious to look at tax breaks for big corporations?
It's pretty obvious.
Because
they own these people.
And you will not look twice at how being in Congress or being in the legislature for 30 years affects that sort of thing. You become beholden to these special interests. But you don't want to look at term limits. You tell me the same thing all the time. Oh, the election, the term limits comes on November 2nd or November 4th or
that's
whatever.
That's what I do say.
Well, I think that's getting a little bit old.
877-301-8970. What's your reaction to this report from Auditor Bump? But basically $1 million a year that is stolen by unnamed people in benefits that are being targeted to 1,164 dead people. What's your reaction? What's your reaction? Do you think there is a double standard in terms of money that goes to poor people versus money that goes to very wealthy people who pal around with legislators? Let's start in Hyannis with Jeff. You are next on Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. Our fault. Hi, Jeff. Thank you.
Hi. Great show.
Thanks.
Great topic,
great.
As always.
Thanks.
Jim, I do agree with you. It seems like a minor amount of money compared to the state budget and tax breaks. However, I'm a former food stamp beneficiary, which I was grateful for, and I still find this completely inexcusable, Jim and Marjorie. My background is computer programming. Just with a $300 Access database, Microsoft, it would take about 5 hours of computer time. You yourself can go on the internet and see that the Social Security publishes what's called a death registry, and they could give access linking that to the Social Security numbers of those people.
That's exactly, by the way, what the auditor was saying. All you got to do is do a cross-check with Social Security numbers.
It's kind of bureaucratic incompetence, or maybe they have a motivation. I'm not sure.
Yes, but I just wanted to put it in a context, and I think the auditor did a great job when she was talking that it could be addressed. That is how easily it could be addressed. Microsoft Access holds 1 million records. I don't think we have 1 million food stamp beneficiaries. And a simple finding matches across the death registry. It honestly would have taken about, after contacting Social Security, maybe an hour to download it, and Access would have done the matches and shown the duplicates.
Can I, Jeff, you know, the reason I'm laughing is not at what you say. This is the exact same conversation we just had with Miles O'Brien about terror watch lists, right, and cross-checking things. All the data is out there, whether it's checking on welfare recipients, whether it's checking for people who are on terrorist watch lists. The humans are not there to do the analysis, apparently, that computers are begging us to do. But Jeff, I agree with every word you said. Thanks so much for the call.
Let's go to Frank in Concord. What do you think, Frank?
Well, it's like the elephant on the table. And in the previous article in regard to Microsoft and Google coming in to resolve a problem with security, every manager should have a report on their desk every morning of any potential fraudulent report from a continuing program that's running 24/7 in the background with these EBT cards, and have them act accordingly every morning and hunt these people down.
Thank you very much, Frank. You know, I think that there is a sense out there that when you lose your EBT card 147 times...
127, but who's counting?
Something is going on, you know.
Can you believe that statistic? 127 times. So was there a machine that just reissued?
People are selling them.
I understand. No, I understand that. You can credibly say, I lost it. You lose stuff all the time. I lose it once,
who
I lose it twice.
Their driver's license?
127 times.
I
agree with you.
I lose everything. Even I haven't lost my driver's license more than like 5 or 10 times.
That's right. So 127 is a bit...
Yeah, it seems a little bit excessive. Our numbers are 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. But we are moving on because we're going to be joined up next by the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy. We have him with us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. Stay tuned for Brian McGroy. We'll talk to him a little welfare, too, and a bunch of other stuff.
I'm Liz Alessi. I live in Cambridge, and I report here. I've just always been a really curious person. A lot of the more interesting stories that I've found have been things that I just stumble upon because they're issues that I hear people talking about and asking questions about, and I have those questions too.
I really think that if patients know better why they're taking their medications, they're more apt to
take them.
My job is
to do the digging and find out more about that. Liz Alessi, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books. And Subaru of New England, offering the all-new redesigned Subaru Forester with symmetrical all-wheel drive. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And Marjorie, every segment today is giving me a headache. I want you to know I'm hoping for a brief respite. Joining us on Open Mic, as he does every Wednesday, is the editor of the Boston Globe. He's also the author of Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. Good afternoon, Brian McGroy.
Good afternoon, Jim Browdy. Consider me a pair of aspirin, would you?
We hope. We'll see.
Well, you know, we do want to ask you, Brian, because we just spoke to State Auditor Suzanne Bump about these fraud in the welfare department. You guys had a story in the Globe today. We had it in the Herald. Do we make too big a deal out of this, or does this just get the juices flowing of people who are anti-poor people?
Well, that's an interesting question, Marjorie, and I'm not sure if we've made too big a deal about it or not, but what bothers me the most about it, and well, there's a bunch of things that bother me, but what bothers me about whether we've made too big a deal, the issue of the lax oversight by the Patrick administration.
Yeah.
And the fact that they were forewarned about this, the fact that this has been going on for a while, the signals have been out there, but there have been no criminal prosecutions. There's been no, it doesn't appear that there has been any real active work on the part of the administration to stem this. That said, are Bump's numbers real? I don't know. We're going to go back and look at that, because right now it seems like within the Department of Transitional Assistance, the welfare department,
they're claiming that there aren't nearly as many dead people who are receiving these benefits as the state auditor has said there is.
I just asked Suzanne Bump about that piece in Adrian Walker's column this morning, saying of 178 in a random sample of dead people, 79 of them were apparently not dead. And Suzanne Bump says that's a separate, I don't quite understand it, a separate 178 apart from the 1,164 who are really dead, Brian. So if you get to the...
Well, that's a bizarre response then, Jim. I mean, they weren't supposed to be separate. They gave the state what was supposed to be a sampling of the people they were looking at, mm-hmm. whether dead or alive. So they weren't supposed to be separate. I don't understand that answer.
Well, you know, nor did I.
I wonder, I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves because who knows if Deval Patrick is going to run for president or not. But if he does in 2016 or 2020, does this kind of stuff come back to haunt him?
It could in a well-crafted Republican ad. That said, whoever's running against him, I'm sure this stuff has happened in their state, too. This is a fraction of the budget. I mean, it's the fraction of a fraction of the budget. It's the type of stuff that is red meat for the anti-poor crowd, but it really doesn't involve a massive amount of money. For me, what it does signal, though, is should the Patrick administration have been a little more upfront on these issues and taking them more seriously earlier.
You guys, Brian, did a great series on Boston Cab and cab drivers being exploited and having to work ridiculously long hours and not making the money they should, and some possible incompetence coming out of City Hall involving the Hackney licensing, et cetera. There's some action happening after your series. What's going on?
Well, there is. It looks like the police department is starting to crack down a little starting to take some action there and starting to make sure that these drivers aren't being abused by medallion owners, taxi cab owners who are, clipping them every which way, whether it be, surcharges, little bribes for taking the cabs out or extra gas money when they bring it back. And it sounds like they're stepping up their oversight at the same time. The Menino administration is pursuing the idea of an independent reviewer. They have put it out to bid. That's been tied up a bit in the bureaucracy. But we have every expectation at the Globe that the mayor is going to follow through on this and that there's going to be a reasonably exhaustive, front-to-back look at how the cab operation works here in Boston.
Yeah, speaking of the mayor, Brian, I wanted to ask you an unrelated question about the mayor. But as you were speaking, I'm thinking if Tom Menino had decided to run for re-election— and let's assume John Connolly, who had declared early, and maybe one other person had run against him. And we went from the broken leg through what he went through before that, and now the prostate surgery, even though on Friday apparently has not apparently, his doctors say has nothing to do with cancer. How do you think voters would have reacted to the sort of endless stream of illnesses on the part of the incumbent mayor running for his, what would have been, seventh term or whatever it was? What do you think the reaction would have been?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, the reality is I have no idea. You have no idea. It would have been a very carefully scripted campaign for a guy like John Connolly, because you want to highlight the fact that the mayor is ailing without angering voters over the fact that that's what you're doing. We had done polls prior to the decision by the mayor. And he was wildly popular in the city, just wildly popular. That said, the electorate felt like, maybe it is time to move on at some point. He does have health issues. He already had health issues at this point. So while he's wildly popular, it's tough to say in the abstract, would they have looked at somebody else like John Connolly? I don't know. But these illnesses, as you well know, certainly wouldn't have helped him.
Yeah, but by the way, I don't want to question your polling. I read that polling, but a study was done afterwards. You may not have seen it. 37% of the people who were polled in that survey were dead, Brian. Did you know that?
Audrey, how do you put up with this campaign?
Okay, moving on. Staying on.
It's not easy. I should get an award.
Who is that old comedian? Is it Henny Youngman or something?
Henny Youngman, yes.
Yeah.
Funniest guy ever.
Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Jim has a poster of him in his bedroom.
I actually do. I have it in my car, too. Now, Brian, speaking of Tom Menino, yesterday Emily Rooney and Margie and I ranted and raved about the commenters on the Menino story in both the Globe and the Herald about him having prostate surgery. In the Herald, 10 of the first 11 were borderline obscene. In the Globe, about, 40% of them had to be deleted by whomever edits the comments on your behalf. Why do newspapers even publish these comments that more often than not are low rent would be a compliment? Why do they run?
I mean, it's a great question, and it's one that the Globe and every other major metro paper has been grappling with for years and years and years. I mean, look, the short answer is people want to have a say. The internet there's a democratization of society through the internet. People like to have a voice. We like to use it to engage your readership, where we give them a voice to comment. The flip side of it is exactly what you saw. I didn't look at these comments on the Menino story. I tell you the truth, I rarely look at these comments. I adhere more to the emails I get from readers than the comments that people post at the end of stories, because oftentimes they just degenerate into the crudest possible conversation imaginable. But it's an issue we continue to grapple with, and you may well see changes there. I mean, a lot of papers have required that people show some form of proof that they are commenting with their real name attached.
That's
to
what
it.
We talked about as the solution, actually.
I'm the Globe, so we have two websites, Boston.com, which is a free website, and Globe.com, which is a subscription website. You have to pay to comment on Globe.com, and the level of sophistication in the comments is incomparable to Boston.com. You know, when you require somebody to pay to be a part of it, or require somebody's name to be on it, it ends up to be, oftentimes a legitimately thoughtful comment.
But, obviously what it does, Brian, is it drives a lot of traffic to websites, because you see people, you've seen the commenters, they're fighting with each other, and it goes on and on and on. And
yeah, it does. It's reader engagement, Marjorie, and it drives traffic, exactly. Yes. So,
and I think that's the reason we're doing it, isn't it?
It is, to a certain extent. It's that, but look, you need a lot of traffic to generate money. I mean, a lot of traffic, and I don't think comments alone are responsible for a ton of money at Boston.com. But there's an expectation among readers that they will have the ability to weigh in on this stuff, and that brings them to the site in general. I think that's the more accurate way to depict it.
When you were a columnist, did you used to read the comments on your columns?
Oh, God, absolutely not.
Is that really true?
No, there's no point.
I never read the comments. I read every email I got, because if somebody took the time to email me, got my email at the end of the column, that means they read to the end of the column, which I think was only done once or twice. But they would email me, and largely I tried to respond to them, depending on how many I got. But I made the effort to respond. Comments at the end of a column, if you read them, and I think Marjorie will vouch for me here, you may never write another column again.
Exactly. It's a masochistic endeavor.
In your mind, it's too easy to think that these people are representative of the readership or society as a whole, and they're not. They're in no way representative of who's out there. And so, you start playing tricks on yourself if you read these comments.
What's the criteria? I mentioned that when Emily Rooney and Marjorie and I were going through the Globe comments on the Menino story yesterday and the Herald comments, a significant number of the Globe comments had been deleted. I forget what the terminology is, that inappropriate or something like that. So
yeah.
Who screen comments, and what's the criterion for exclusion? It's obviously not something's in poor taste, because a lot of them are. What causes it to rise or lower to the level that causes it to be excised by whomever edits these things?
I mean, it's like the Supreme Court definition of pornography.
Yeah.
You know it when you see it. And I can't, look at the, obviously there are keywords that set it off. Readers can actually click a button that call a comment to our attention, and a producer will go on and delete it. And that happens quite frequently. We have producers on our websites who comb through the comments regularly, and it falls into one of these things where you just know it's in poor taste when you see it. We tend to err on the side of letting these things in, but, our sense is that, we'd rather let them in, but when they're in poor taste, we delete them.
You know, that's got to be a tough job, talking about seeing the lowest common denominator for 8 hours every day, the burnout. I'd be really depressed
luckily,
reading
Marjorie,
comments
people,
all day.
these people do other things.
Good.
They're really talented producers, and this is just one, because you would really want to fling yourself off a bridge if it's what you did all day. It's awful.
You
it's
would.
Awful.
You know, speaking of BostonGlobe.com, I read something this morning that I guess has been going on for a while, but forgive me, I just noticed it today. You're doing this thing with Dennis Lehane. You're going to be interviewing Dennis Lehane, the great writer, you know, Mystic River and all the two detectives and stuff like that. But you have this whole deal going on where people that are, I think they have to be subscribers, can come get tours of the newsroom. You get this whole website opportunity for like interaction in person with the Globe. What is it?
How have you just cottoned on to our world famous Globe Insiders program?
You know, I should have seen it earlier, but I haven't.
It is amazing. So these subscribers, you know, who get a digital subscription can sign up for this, what we call the Globe Insiders program. And they can sign up to come to a morning news meeting every Friday. We have a bunch of outsiders in who sit in on the morning news meeting. They sit there for half an hour. Then we go around and wake each and every one of them up and tell them it's time to go home. We do different programs for them. Last week, we had a panel discussion with several Globe editors about our coverage of the April 15 bombings and the aftermath. And we actually filled the place up. I think there were 100 people or so there. We have lectures by our film reviewers, our art critics. We do all sorts of different programs for subscribers. And the response, I'll confess, I've been really surprised by it. It's been pretty terrific.
You know, I'm a Globe Insider, and I have never been invited to any of these things, Brian. I'm serious.
Jim, I'll tell you what. You wait by your phone. Don't let it out of your sight. I'm going to have somebody call you because, you know, we got to get you in.
Brian, you mentioned the meeting just a second ago when you were responding to Marjorie's question about this Globe Insider thing about the marathon follow-up. Mike Resendez and some of his colleagues at the Globe have done great stories about this triple murder on September 11th of 2011 in Waltham, which now authorities are suggesting, at least we've read in your paper, the older Tsarnaev could have been intimately involved in, and his friend Tadashev, who was killed in Orlando by the FBI about a week or so, may have been also. Are you as frustrated as I think most of us are by the lack of information forthcoming from authorities in Waltham about what they did and didn't do in the year and a half between September 11th of 2011 and the marathon?
I know, frustrated on every front, Jim. I mean, triple murders are not common in general. In suburbia, they're outright bizarre. And as you point out, there's been an absolute lack of information that has come out of Waltham. There's been a lack of information about what was done and, you know, now more to the point, what wasn't done in the investigation of that triple murder on the anniversary, 10th anniversary of 9/11. It's really frustrating. But look, we're also frustrated with the lack of information that's coming out of the federal government on the shooting of what now turns out to be a potentially prime suspect in that murder in Orlando a week or so ago. We're getting precious little out about that.
We're also getting conflicting information. We all know the first reports were that this Tadashev guy allegedly had a knife where he was coming after at least the FBI, if not the Mass State Police guys. And then subsequently, two of them who were there, I assume the state cops from Massachusetts, says they're not sure there was a knife involved. That's a pretty basic detail, isn't it?
It's a very basic detail. And look, at any time you have a police shooting of a civilian, whether a suspect or not, you know, if I'm the authorities, I err on the side of getting information out there. So we are frustrated on many fronts. We're, you know, pleased that people like Ed Davis have said that the authorities from Massachusetts were absolutely down there to talk to this guy, the dead guy, about the triple murder in Waltham. So at least we have that much to go on. But it has been a frustrating slog on this. And, you know, from my point of view, needlessly so.
Brian, last thing from me, getting back to the rather sore subject, this Globe Insider issue and my exclusion from it. If I had ever been at a meeting and you, I assume at these meetings you say, do you have any stories you might want us to cover that we have? I assume you ask those kind of questions, right?
Of who, the insiders?
Yes.
Well, usually, like I said, they're sound asleep.
So. Okay, well, fine. Let's assume you did ask and I was one of the insiders. Yeah. I assume you know who New Hampshire farmer Julie Baker is. Is that correct?
Help me out with that.
Well, I'm assuming you do. Now, you are the author, you're the author of Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. Is that correct?
Marjorie, help me out here.
No, you don't need any help, Brian. Julie Baker, as you well know, Brian, had you done your homework, is the woman behind the e-commerce site Pampered Poultry. Have you heard of that?
I have heard of Pampered Poultry. Okay. I had no idea. Okay, go ahead, Jim.
Now, here's what they do, Brian. I would suggest you do a little story on this, if you don't mind a little advice from a subscriber to your paper. They sell chicken diapers, and they sell saddles. This is the part that involves your history. Sells saddles to protect against the, quote, not-so-gentle gentleman roosters. Now, is that not a story begging to be told, Brian?
I will tell you offline, off air, sometime about our experiment with a chicken diaper.
No, that's household. Is that true?
It is 100% true. So we don't need to get into it here. But the larger point is, you are now blacklisted from the Globe Insider program. You will be the first and only subscriber, assuming you are one, who has been blacklisted from this program.
I'll wear that as a badge of honor.
You won't be able to go to any meetings. You won't be able to see Brian and Dennis Lehane, Jim.
Hey, Brian McGrory, editor of the Globe. Thanks so much for your time. We'll talk to you next Wednesday.
Jim, always a pleasure. Marjorie, thank you.
Thank you, Brian, very much. Brian is, of course, the editor of the Boston Globe, and he does join us every Wednesday. And tomorrow, open mic at 1 o'clock, we'll be with Christopher Lydon and his take on donning that mortarboard here in graduation season. Okay, so when it comes to cleanliness, where do you rate yourself? You're a very clean guy, Jim. I like to think I'm a clean guy. Are you a germaphobe, too, with a penchant for Purell, or are you free range, choosing to coexist with germs and pesticides and other frowned-upon microbes? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Perks of a driverless car could be more than just a hands-free experience, you know.
Older people could live on their own longer if they don't have to drive themselves. Drunk driving wouldn't be such a big concern, which is good news for restaurants and bars.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Freakonomics goes riding shotgun with a car-driving computer. It's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Legal Seafoods, visiting the docks daily in search of the freshest seafood and testing it for purity in their lab. More information available at LegalSeafoods.com. Legal Seafoods, if it isn't fresh, it isn't legal. And Leahy Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LeahyHealth.org. That's LeahyHealth.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy. It's me and Marjorie Egan. Here's how the New York Times posed this important question. I'm reading verbatim. Compared with the rest of the world, Americans take personal hygiene and disinfection to another level. From white teeth to the daily shower to manicured lawns, most of us cherish our unsoiled, unstained existence. And then they ask these questions, which we'd like to ask you at 877-301-8970. What makes us so eager to be clean? Is it nobler, the Times asks, and healthy, or should we relax a little? 877-301-8970. We really have become, Marjorie, Purell Nation.
We have.
There is no place from the supermarket, I understand in a hospital, obviously, from the supermarket to schoolhouses to out, I mean, there is virtually nowhere you can go where you cannot be all Purelled up in a matter of seconds. It's unbelievable.
What you can also do now, as most everybody knows, is you can go into the supermarket or Whole Foods or wherever it is and get a mini wipe to
rub the railing on the cart.
Or to put under your hands.
You use it?
No.
You know what's unbelievable? It really is. We talked about this a couple of years ago on the radio in our former existence, and all these studies show that Purell is this alcohol-based sanitizer, right? And they show that the primary reason why people buy these alcohol-based sanitizers are to prevent respiratory infections and those kind of things. How well do they work?
They don't work.
They don't work at all. By the way, they don't work a little. They don't work at all on these kinds of things. Despite that fact, the obsession, and it really is an obsession with being germ-free in this germ warfare era is totally and completely out of control. By the way, everything I've read about this through the years, you know what they say? Wash your hands.
Wash your hands.
Wash your hands.
A lot.
End of discussion. Don't spend money on all this stuff. I don't know what Purell stock, and I mean not just Purell, but all the Purells of the world. Everybody. Remember we had a foreign producer whom we loved. What did he have in his pocket every day?
Purell.
A little bottle of Purell in his jeans pocket.
And he would open doors with his elbow because he didn't want to touch any of the germs in his
doors.
He's
not alone in that regard. But I almost find it laughable. And, you know, one of the things that comes up, and I'm sure someone will say this too, most of us grew up without Purell. I don't think it even existed. Most of us opened bathroom doors not using our elbows when we were 20 and 30 years old or 10 years old. How did we make it this far?
Well, you know, anybody who was ever a school teacher or a daycare worker, and I used to work in a daycare, it's the same story that the first month you're there or the 2 months you're there, you're sick nonstop because the little kids, you know, they're little germ machines and they're putting everything in their mouth. They're touching you. You're touching them. But then after like 2 months, you become like Superman. You don't get any more, you don't get any more colds. You don't get any more flus because it's like you go through the, you become inured to all those different germs. So I think that's the thing with Purell. You're killing all the good microbes, whatever they are.
Are you not surprised? You know, one of the things, if you have a friend who you spend a decent amount of time with or a coworker, and you only know them in a certain forum, you know them in the newsroom, you know them at school when you're picking up a kid, and all of a sudden you enter a new realm with them. Like, for example, you bump into them in a supermarket, and when you see the same person that you consider to be totally normal in regular circumstances, Purelling themselves up from the tip of their head to the bottom of the, you say to yourself,
or with a mask and gloves.
No, really, I have to say, it's one of the, there are many things that I don't get that I at least understand. This is not one of them.
Oh, I get it. I get
it.
What is it?
It's
from advertising.
Howard Hughes?
Because we're worried that we're going to have bad smells, or we're worried we're going to get bad germs, or we're worried that we're going to offend somebody. So, you know, you barrage with this advertising all the time. Thank God, less of it, because you can flash through them with your remote control.
Wait. I understand advertising for deodorant. That's one. What advertising is saying stay germ-free in your 24/7 existence.
The Purell ads that talk about disinfectants and Clorox and the Clorox wipes, and you know that babies are you know going to get sick from all these things. I mean, it's amazing when I think about it. Remember the ball piss when your kids were little at Chuck E. Cheese.
Also at McDonald's they had them.
I mean, the kids went on those ball piss. I mean, if all these germ theories were true, they'd all come out of there with these terrible diseases. And they also point out in all these stories about Purell that a lot of the flu germs are spread in the air. You know,
but you know what they also, I mean, the thing to scare people, every month or two, there's a study that says your kitchen sink has more bacteria than your toilet does.
Your sponge.
Phone does, exactly. More. But all it does is it generates fear in people. And you get the sense that I don't know this to be a fact, who's sponsoring most of these reports?
Purell.
The Purells of the world, really. 877-301-8970. So we want to know if you're part of what I'll generically call Purell Nation, or if you are more sane, like Margie and I are, about your cleanliness issues.
Liz in the car, what do you think about Purell? To Purell or not to Purell, Liz?
Hi, I am very Purell, and I am having some issues with anxiety right now because I'm in the car. I can't find my Purell. I do one-on-one in-home ABA with young kids with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And his mom changed his diaper when he was there, and I heard her go like, oh, he put his hand in it, and then I have to work with him and not equally in soap.
You know, Ella, let me be clear. In that situation, I would cleanliness is obviously the direction in which you should go. But would you not agree that's an aberrational situation? That's not like one's normal connection to the world, right?
Oh, no. It's not a normal situation. Well, in my job, it comes up more than you think.
Right, but in those settings, I guess what I'm saying, it makes total sense. Now, how are you in the when you're not doing what you do for a living, how are you, what's your interaction with the Purell world and the rest of the world?
Well, I heard you mention something about the sink, and I definitely clean my sink with Comet every week.
You do.
I didn't need to hear that study to already be in that.
So habit. How do you have time to do anything, Liz? Do you ever have time to go to a movie, or are you just cleaning up all the time?
No extra time.
Okay, Liz, thank you so much for your honesty. We appreciate it.
Well, they do say, they have the scary things about sponges. That was one of the things I read this morning. Again, yeah. I've read it before, that your sponge has got more germs in it than
put it in the microwave.
The
do you know that's the trick?
Stall. That's
do you know
really,
that?
In the microwave?
Just put it in the microwave
put it in the
15
dishwasher.
Seconds. Put it in the dishwasher.
Really, 15 seconds in the microwave?
I made that up. But I
put it in the dishwasher.
Someone say
I've
that.
Done that too, but it kind of they're a little messed up and they come out of the dishwasher. I don't know if they can take the stress, all that moving around with the hot water. 617, it's 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Are we like over Purelling in the world, or are we not over Purelling in the world? Public swimming pools, that's another thing. get nervous about those, Jim?
Well, yes, because we don't have to describe why, but as a little boy, I went to public swimming pools. I know what little boys and girls do in them. So that, again, you know what the problem is? You're picking an aberrational activity, a public swimming, mm-hmm. going to public, and the woman Liz who called, obviously she's taking care of somebody whose life is such that you have to take extra precautions. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the example you pick. When I go to the supermarket, I go to Whole Foods, for example, and I see people wiping down with the same passion that they use for, I don't know, whatever activity. You say to yourself, what world am I living
but
in?
As I'm saying, I worked in a daycare. What do you think you do in daycare? You should change diapers.
Well, that makes sense. But there it makes sense, obviously.
I wasn't Purelling. You just weren't. Wash your hands. You just wash your hands. You don't have to do the Purell. 99% and 9/10. What is the Ivory soap? 99.9%
pure. 30 years ago, I think.
And it floats.
That. It does float.
It's very important, Jim.
Where are we going next?
Larry in the truck. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Larry. Larry, sorry, it was our fault. Hey, Larry.
How you doing?
Excellent. Thanks for the call. Go.
Thank you. I was just saying, I was just thinking, you know, my brother has two girls and got a 4 and 2, and he keeps them overly sanitized, even so much to go, so far as to go is that they, aside from school and daycare, they really don't have any interaction with other kids. And
why?
And,
because of his fear of germs?
Yeah, oh, he's a wicked germaphobe. He sanitizes everything. Everything. I mean, and his kids are always sick, you know, whether it be a cold or the flu or, you know, whatever the case may be. And my kids, when I brought them up, I have two girls also that are 23 and 19. And when they were younger, they were just like, go out and play in the ball pit, go to Chuck E. Cheese, go play with other kids. And they were hardly ever sick. So I think over sanitizing, it defeats the purpose of developing immune systems against the germs that they're afraid of.
Larry, did you ever have a conversation with your brother about how he's bringing up his kids?
No, because my brother basically, he's got a PhD in organic chemistry, so he's smarter than everybody else. and I'm just a truck driver, so I know nothing.
I'd vote for you, Larry. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. Larry brings up a great point. When you do this Purell thing, like nonstop to an extreme, you create a fear in your children growing up that is immense. Would you not agree with that? I mean, this whole notion that anywhere they go, if they're not Purelled up, they're going to get infections or they're going to get some horrible thing to happen to them. I'm with Larry. Let your kids go in the balls at McDonald's or Chuck E. Cheese.
But what's
or
the thing that they're hitting you up for at the beginning of the
what
year
when
teachers want extra supplies? What is
yeah,
one
Purell.
Of them they ask for? Purell.
Okay, fine.
That is correct. Kleenex, magic markers, Purell. That's right on the list.
Let's go to Kale in New Hampshire. She's on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hello there, Kale.
Hi. I was going to say you have to leave the Purell behind because your immune system has to be built up. That's a perfect thing. But if you're going to be like a germaphobe about one thing, you're going to be crazy about everything. I used to work in a hotel. You wouldn't believe what happens in the hotels. So you would like never leave your home or anything like that. You just, you know, most of us survived. You know, and the few of us that didn't, oh well, you know.
Oh well, she says.
You know, look at politicians. Look how they spend their time shaking hands all the time. And we just talked about Chris Christie and Barack Obama. They're out there shaking hands all the time. Now, I'm sure they have some Purell in the car and stuff. But they are getting germs. All
who allegedly does
long.
Not shake hands,
anybody?
Who's in and out of politics?
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is a famous no handshaker, and I think for that reason, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's Howard Hughesian in terms of his germophobia, but he's
but
close. What were you
going
to say, Kale? I'm sorry. You had another thought?
I was going to just say that I grew up with horses, and I mean, one of the great joys is, you know, you're mucking, you're cleaning, and people who are in gardens with cow manure, I mean, those are the healthy people. I rarely get sick. And it's just you have to just get over it and go do something to get you away from that fear.
Thank you very much, Kale. I think that was brilliantly put. You're a very sensible woman. Not everybody is. And that's why they're Purelling to beat the ban in all these schools. Have you seen lining up before lunch? Did you see this in your kids' school?
No.
Lining up before lunch with a container of Purell. And as the kids go by, they're supposed to Purell before they go into the cafeteria.
Like a mandatory kind of thing?
Well, they're 6 and 7, so they do what the teacher
why,
tells
why
them to
can't
do.
You just wash your hands? Why can't you wash your
I
hands?
I do not know that, Jim.
Okay.
I did not ask. I did not want to antagonize
anybody. Don't ask,
anybody.
Don't tell. Exactly.
Tanya in New Hampshire, what do you think? Do you Purell or not Purell?
I do not Purell. I do not Purell my three kids, even though they're dirty all the time. But what I've noticed now is this new phenomenon since my kids, they didn't have it when my kids were babies, but you go to the supermarket or Walmart
and you see these people putting these huge cloth quilt contraptions with leg holes over the cart so they can put their baby in it, a toddler, so the baby doesn't touch any part of the cart.
I love this.
Oh, my God.
I've never seen
it,
but I love
those?
But I love the concept.
There's a huge market for them, and they're all made in, you know, colorful patterns that kids will like. Some of them have toys sewn on them. It's crazy.
That is unbelievable.
But it's a natural extension of what we're talking about. It makes total, even though I hadn't seen it, it makes total sense to me.
When did this start happening? When did we become so obsessed with this?
Tanya, thanks for the call. I don't know. Well, what's the name of that thing where you can buy stuff when you have infants so that they don't stick their fingers in the wall plugs? First something. What's that? It's a huge product. They sell everything.
You just stick it in.
Yeah,
it's
not just there. It's to protect your kid from everything. Whenever that happened, I think it was like 20 plus years ago, but I'm not sure. That's when people started getting paranoid about all these things that could happen to children. And by the way, let me be clear. I obviously err on the side of safety, particularly when it involves a kid. But don't do it in such a way that it scares the crap out of everybody, which this stuff really does.
George in the car. What do you think, George?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in the business of selling sanitation to food processing plants, to nursing homes, hospitals, and the general public and businesses for flu season, things of that nature.
Yeah.
I use alcohol gel sanitizer in my car because I'm shaking hands, I'm touching doors all day long. Washing your hands with soap and water is the best possibility, but some of these portable sanitizers are better than nothing, and they do kill germs. You know, there's a bug going around nursing homes called C. difficile. And it is, once it gets out of hand, it's an epidemic, and everybody has...
Yeah, I know what it is. You don't have to describe what the consequences of it. They're unfortunate, to say the least. But George, you mentioned the flu. Virtually everything that I've read, a lot of people do the Purelling in flu season to avoid getting the flu. But from what I've read, there's nothing in Purell that would prevent you from getting the flu. Is that not correct? It's just this fiction that people live with, no?
Well, one of the single most important transmitter of bacteria is your hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody sneezes in their hand, touches your doorknob, you come out, those bacteria and viruses can live for a short time on a hard surface. And now you got it in your hand, and you rub your eye, and voila. That's how most people get
flu. How long do these bacteria live on a hard surface, like the handle on a door? Roughly how long do they live?
I couldn't tell you how long, but it's not long.
So how's business? You're making more money than you ever made, right, George? Listen to George.
One other thing.
Yeah, George.
Being a road warrior, I use restrooms all the time in McDonald's and other places.
Yeah.
And I would hate to tell you how many men I see who just go do their business and go out without washing their hands. Now, they've touched that door. And I got to touch it, and I touch it with my elbow if I have to.
I got
it. If it opens in, I use a 3x5 card, which I carry in my pocket for notes anyway. I ain't touching that doorknob.
Okay, George. We'll see you at the bank, George. Thank you very much for your call.
Well, we have done a lot of stories about how men are not very good about washing their hands compared to women.
Their surveys all suggest that men do it in bathrooms. Yeah. Leading bathrooms do it at a far lower rate than women do.
And there are the distressing stories about hospitals, where they think that the rate is about 75%.
Did you read some of these stories this morning?
Washing their hands.
That's a place where that got me nervous. Forget Purell. That some significant percentage of medical personnel was in the low 20s or 30s, you said, don't wash their hands in between patients.
Right.
Now, that's troubling.
About 75% wash, yeah. So at least 25% that don't. That's a little creepy.
How weird. Before we finish this, when George just mentioned what we have talked about, the elbow opening, when you see somebody doing the elbow open.
Yeah.
Here's
why you do it. Because I've done this myself. Because you just finished washing your hands, right?
Yeah.
And you know all the stories about people who don't wash their hands. So, I do. Because if you just wash your hands, you're kind of defeating the purpose if you put your hand on the doorknob that the person who didn't wash their hands just put their hand on.
So what do you do? Wait a second. So I understand you can use the elbow
if
you
want to
push out. What if the door is a push in? You're leaving the women's room. So what do you do? You get a paper towel?
Use your teeth.
No, No, I'm serious. What do you use? Dental floss? You wrap it around the handle and pull it. What do you do? You use a paper towel?
You put your foot through the door.
I'm serious. I mean,
well, you're going in, so it's different. You can go in. You can wash your hands.
No, I'm saying. But when you're leaving, the door usually opens in. If it opens in, you can't use an elbow to open the door. You never thought of this before?
I've not confronted that door before, okay, Jim. Fine. I'm usually on the open out, and I'm safe with my elbow.
Can you report tomorrow noon about your experiences? No, I'm serious. In between now and...
Remember when we did the study in the bathroom? You went in there and did some investigative reporting?
At our former station.
And how many men were washing their hands?
None. No, essentially I wash my hands, only because I was afraid I'd be outed at the end of the thing. So in any case, wash your hands is the bottom line. Wash your hands, get a flu shot. That's basic advice. And that's the end of the story.
Okay. We're going to come back in a moment to talk to a woman who has kept the family advice business very well. After 15 years of dispensing advice, so she is closing up shop. We're going to have an exit interview with advice columnist Margo Howard next on Boston Public Radio.
Deepak and Sanjeev Chopra both followed in their father's footsteps and became doctors, but one chose Western medicine and the other took a spiritual approach. Now they've teamed up for a memoir.
They say if you have a near-death experience, your life flashes back. Well, we could sort of achieve this without dying.
Deepak and Sanjeev Chopra talk about their new book, Brotherhood, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Harvard Extension School Online Certificate in Strategic Management. Information session Wednesday, June 12th. More information available at extension.harvard.edu. And Nova, the marathon bombings led to a manhunt that captivated a nation. What roles did modern technology and old-fashioned police work play in the search? Manhunt, Boston Bombers, Wednesday at 9 on WGBH 2.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In studio joining us is the queen of advice columnists, the daughter of Ann Landers. She continued in that tradition for years and years, but now, it's almost sad to say this, Dear Margo is no more. I don't mean you're no more, but as Dear Margo, you're no more. The retired or semi-retired great Margo Howard joins us in Studio 3. Hi there, Margo.
Hi, you all.
Margo, before we talk about what you've done for many years and everything else, most people, you know, when they leave work, they say, oh, I'm going to spend more time with my family. You did not say that. Do you remember what you said?
I did.
What did you say?
I said, I'm not leaving to spend more time with my family. I'm leaving to spend more time with my inner child, the one who sleeps late, shops, reads, cleans up her closet.
Yeah, why has you really lunch with the girls. Hey, I love that part, too.
You know, all I can remember is the great interview Larry King did with Seinfeld. He said something like, were you upset when your show was canceled? And Seinfeld says, canceled? We were number one. In any case, you're going out on top. This isn't like, why did you decide to end this thing?
At the time just seemed right. The poor newspaper business, which I've been in since I was 28 years old, mm-hmm. and now I'm 110. The business is in terrible trouble. A lot of my clients were in bankruptcy, some chains that carried me. It was just getting sad. And
it's making Marjorie feel great what you're saying, by the way, but go ahead.
You're probably next, but
so
anyway.
That's nice.
Thank you.
So wait a second. So you just decided the time is right.
You know, the time had come. Some of the girls were doing 5 columns a week or 7 columns a week, and I was only doing 1 column a week. It was like 4 letters, you know, 2 and 2. So it was relaxation for me for many years, and it only started to become not fun when the quality of the letters changed. More people were writing me to disagree with me or to agree with me. And when I started having to worry about the letters, I thought, you know, this is a logical end to this.
When you say the quality of the letters changed, that part that they were following up and disagreeing that they were more strident?
I didn't care about the comments, but they were starting to outnumber the questions I was getting.
Okay.
And I really felt that I have said everything. I have been writing advice for 15 years, and I was a proper newswoman for 30 years before that.
Yeah.
We're talking to Margot Howard. And by the way, if you say to yourself, I can't live without Dear Margot, and you want a final piece of free advice, you can give her a buzz at 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. These sort of the retirement advice of Margot Howard.
You know, I said this to you before, Margot Howard. Your mother was Ann Landers. And I remember being, you know, a 10-year-old, 12-year-old kid, 15-year-old kid growing up in Fall River, reading my local newspaper, which ran Ann Landers. And it really was a big deal to me.
Huge.
Because you didn't talk that much to your parents about a lot of touchy things like sex and drugs and so forth. And your mother was pretty hip. I remember thinking as a teenager, she's giving pretty outside-the-box advice. She was very liberal in a lot of her ideas, at least when I was reading her. And that was, you know, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago?
She brought up three generations of kids.
She did.
I was always surprised that kids read her, teenagers read her. And I always lied and denied that I read her because I thought, oh, you know, that stuff. But and I also remember the column you wrote when she died, which touched me greatly.
Oh, thank you.
About children reading her, Dan Savage from Savage Love,
yep.
Who's become a great gay activist. We got to be friends. And he said that he was a geeky gay kid in the suburbs of Chicago, and if it had not been for her column, he doesn't know what he would have done.
That's a great story.
And my mother, I think she had more power than people understood. She got behind causes, and she picked her spots very carefully. And she was one of the people who was instrumental in getting homosexuality as an illness or a disease out of the DSM.
Good for her.
Yeah.
And hey, where did that come from? I mean, because, you know, she was obviously not a young woman when she was doing this. Where did that come from?
She just had her finger to the wind of the time. She was able to learn and to change and evolve. And she evolved. She was very medically savvy. She was tied to Harvard Medical School for 23 years on the visiting committee. She felt it was her obligation to educate her readers, and she had 90 million readers.
Hey,
90 million readers.
I heard that, 90 million. Hey, Margot, did you tell us when you were at our other radio station a couple of years ago, did you tell us that one of your babysitters when you were a kid was Elizabeth Taylor? How did that happen? I mean, what?
When I was 12, which was 1952, we were vacationing in Palm Springs because we lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which was like the tundra. My mother just hated it. And so we would take these long winter vacations, and my teachers would play along. They would send work for me to do, and I did it. I was rather studious. Hard to believe, I know, but I was. And so we're at the pool, and I never was in the sun because I didn't like it. And that's why my face doesn't look like an alligator handbag.
It does not. It looks beautiful.
At the age of 110.
110.
So mother and I were at the pool. I was under an umbrella reading, and she and Elizabeth Taylor were at poolside sunning. In those days, nobody said that's not a good thing. And Elizabeth Taylor saw mother mixing up the iodine and baby oil, the ancient suntan lotion. Mm-hmm. And she said, you ought to do what I do, use Jergens lotion. So they got to be buddies, and then I was introduced to her, and she was very nice to me, and she shared her comic books with me, and my mother didn't let me read comic books. And I only thought later, why is a 19-year-old girl reading comic books? But anyway, she was really more than kind, and she signed 30 pictures for my class at home. And so we were all pool pals, and then she was dating Stanley Donen before he was a big deal, the director. And they were sweet to me. And one night, mother was complaining, I guess, that she and father had somewhere to go. She couldn't get one of the maids to sit with me. And Elizabeth said, well, Stanley and I will. I thought, what? What? Is this true? So it was really heaven. And I could go. There's a really terrible ending to the story. So we had a wonderful time. We had dinner at Arcasita. And then she suggested I go in and do homework. And when I was tired, go to bed, but they'd be out there. Well, our casita was right by the pool. So instead of doing homework or doing anything else, I was looking out the window, and it paid off because they went skinny dipping.
Oh, my God.
Wait, that's the bad ending or the good ending?
No, that was a good ending.
I should say so.
Like if I died, I would have died happy. And so I saw her a few times over the years as a grown-up because of Irv Kupcinet, who was the gossip column in Chicago.
Yeah.
And his daughter, his late daughter, Cookie, and I were part of a clique at our little high school. And so I was invited for all the festivities when they had somebody fun around. And she remembered, and then I saw her another time. And the last time I saw her, here's where it gets bad. I was married to Ken Howard, and I was one of the few spouses in the green room for the Night of 100 Stars. Do you remember the first
yes,
one?
Yes, actually, I do.
Alex and Hildy Cohen did it, and that was really something. I mean, Princess Grace was there, and
wow,
and all the movie stars were exchanging posters. Everybody should sign everybody's poster. So Alex Cohen was very smart. He knew this taping would take forever, so he didn't have a bar there because a few stars are known to have a nip now and then. So, but Al Pacino brought his own treats in his pocket in the form of a powder, and Liz Taylor brought something to drink in a paper bag. I didn't know this, and she was also in the bag, so I see her sitting on a sofa with Zev Braun, who is a producer. So I'm showing off with Ken Howard. I said, you want to meet Elizabeth Taylor? He says, sure. So I go over there, and I sort of, she's on a sofa, and I kind of kneeled down. I get lower to be at her level. And I said, I don't know if you remember, but you were my babysitter. Well, then I thought, that is not a good opening to an aging actress.
Yeah.
And she didn't say anything, and she just sort of looked at me. And when I get nervous, I keep talking. A normal person would split, you know, just be quiet and go. And I'm going and going and going, and she's not saying a word. She's looking at me. And Ken Howard gently leads me away by the elbow.
And that was the end of your Elizabeth Taylor thing?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. That's
but,
too
you know,
bad.
In the tradition of Elizabeth Taylor, you've also been married like a dozen times. Is that not correct?
No, she
Give
hasn't.
Or take, how many?
Depends what you call a dozen.
Exactly. Now, Margo, we're not going to ask you.
Right. Number four.
Number four is
yes,
my lucky number as
that's
well.
Right.
I understand that. I don't want to know. We don't want to know the typical best letter, worst. What's the letter? What's the letter in your Dear Margot career that got you in most trouble, Margot?
It's not a letter. It's something. It's a question that I've revisited more than once.
Okay,
and
what is it?
And it has to do with religion. This started when I was at Slate as Dear Prudence, and it carried over to Dear Margot when I left Slate. I had a letter that gave me an opening, and I said that religious wars were simply terrible, and they sort of fed back to religion. And then I said, more people have died fighting over who has the better imaginary friend. Well, the sky fell in. So I've been at that for some years because it annoys me that the Bible Belters want to tell everybody else what to do. So my very most favorite letter, which I carry around in my wallet because I love it so much, said, Dear Margot, I've never written to an advice columnist in my life, but one of your answers really set me off. A woman asked for your advice about someone in her family telling her husband that he might not go to heaven since he's not a Christian. Well, I've been a Christian for 50 years, and I can tell you that her family member is exactly right. You cannot enter the gates of heaven unless you ask forgiveness of your sins and accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior. It is all very clear in the Bible. No ifs, ands, or buts. You either believe it or you don't go to heaven. That is our belief. Now, if you want to believe something else, that is your prerogative. Just don't expect to go to heaven.
Wow.
The scripture explaining all of this is very clear. If you plan on several million Christians continuing to read your column, then I suggest you write a retraction, signed Follower of Jesus Christ.
I'm sure you wrote a retraction.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, as was my style, I wrote Dear Fall. I always took the first syllable of the writer's name. I said a retraction? I don't think so. Here's the thing. I find your letter a perfect example of someone who's been indoctrinated to reject and diminish anything with which she does not agree. What you are saying is that other people's gods are wrong, and such a view is narrow-minded and disrespectful to billions of good people who believe differently. When you say, that is our belief, let us parse that. It is your belief, and a belief is not a fact. Neither is it knowledge. It is an opinion about something that cannot be proved. Your Bible, the New Testament, was written by different people after Jesus died, with John's Gospel written 100 years A.D. 100 years! The scholarship on the subject is that the written version came from the oral teachings of different sects, not unlike the way myths are passed on. I greatly admire people of faith, but I don't think any learned theologian would embrace your my way or the highway approach to religion, especially considering that God's message is said to be one of love. And isn't humility supposed to be a Christian virtue? I must tell you that your advisory, believe what you like, just don't expect to go to heaven, makes your hoped-for destination sound a bit like a restricted country club.
Now, you know what's amazing about that? The fact that Michelle Bachmann wrote you even before she was a member of Congress is amazing, Margot Howard. Hey, Kathy from Attleboro wants to talk to you. You're on the phone on Boston Public Radio with the great Margot Howard. Hey there, Kathy. Hey, Kathy.
I've been retired for 4 years, and one of the things that I've been able to connect with my inner child has been reading your column during each morning, drinking coffee, looking out the window. And all those things that you're going to do in retirement, cleaning out your closets, getting up late, it's just wonderful. You'll love it.
Well, thank you, my dear. I tell you, I'm going to continue writing, but just not an advice column. I have a book in mind.
What kind of book? What are you going to write about?
Not going to tell you.
Oh, come on.
Can't.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Nonfiction.
Oh, good. I hope we hear more about Elizabeth Taylor.
I was just going to say.
Around the pool.
Hey, Kathy, thank you for the call. What are you going to do? So you're going to write. That's a piece of the action for you. What else are you going to do with yourself? I mean, you know everybody. I mean, obviously that is a ticket to something.
I don't know why people say that.
But you do.
Well, nobody knows everybody.
You know a lot of people.
Okay.
You know, your sister, your mother and her sister, twins, mm-hmm. and they both, one was Dear Abby and one was Ann Landers, and there was a certain rivalry there. Did they make peace at the end of their lives?
Of a sort.
They did?
Of a sort.
Okay.
It was cordial, but it was never the same. Because my mother was always trying to stop being a twin, and my aunt wanted to continue on, almost like a vaudeville act.
Yeah.
And when she followed my mother into the advice business, that was really trouble, and they didn't speak for quite a long time. And then when they sort of patched it up, they agreed not to talk about their work, but it was never the same.
And how did you decide to do this?
I didn't decide.
How did it happen that you began
Michael Kinsley was asked by Bill Gates to start Slate Magazine, and he was in the American Enterprise Institute building in Washington where Herb Stein was, Nixon's economist. And they met in the elevator, and Herb by then had retired. And he said to Kinsley, what are you doing here? Because it's kind of a right-wing building. And Michael said, I'm starting a magazine for Bill Gates. He said, I want to write an advice column. And so Herb Stein picked the name Prudence. And they referred it by saying, send your questions of romance, relationships, and macroeconomics. And people did. And then after a year, his wretched son, Ben Stein, said, you shouldn't be doing this, Pop. It's not decorous. And the old man quit. And Michael, who had been my editor at the New Republic and knew me very well, we had become good social friends, said, he got in touch with me and he said, I know you want nothing to do with advice, which was true. Because when I went in the news business and was syndicated and I had a rather fast rise, all the women's magazines plus I Penthouse, I think, asked me to write an advice column, and I always declined and said, yeah, that's her deal. It does not interest me. So when Michael got a hold of me, I'd already moved to Boston. I had been writing Lunch on the Left Bank for Boston Magazine, and then when that came to an end, I was basically sitting on my ass. Can you say that?
You did.
You just said
okay.
it.
Okay. Now you're a garage here at WGBH.
We were just canceled, too, so you can now say anything you want. So, hey, Margo, we only have, unfortunately, we have 30 seconds.
Oh, my God.
How do people stay in touch with you? I mean, if they want, they don't want no Margo in their life. I mean, they're waiting for this book, but what do they do in the interim? How do they find you?
Well, Doug Most at the Globe asked the same question because people were writing, how do we find
her? Yeah, what's the answer?
It's Letter for Margo.
F-O-R?
Yes.
Letter for Margo.
At yahoo.com.
Letter for Margo at yahoo.com.
So you might read them, but you won't respond.
Depends.
Okay.
Depends. Margo Howard, it's great to see you.
Thank you so much.
Huge, huge fans of yours. Okay, that's it for another edition of Boston Public Radio. You know what's on open mic tomorrow, Marjorie Egan?
Open mic tomorrow is Christopher Lydon.
You know what he's talking about?
Graduation.
That is what he's talking about. And tomorrow night is the Boston Strong concert, obviously to raise a ton of money for the One Fund Boston. We're going to talk to some of the talent from that on tomorrow's show. In the interim, you can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. You can tweet us at BOS, short for Boston, BOS Public Radio. I'm on Twitter at Jim Browdy. Marjorie's on Twitter at Marjorie Egan. That's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow at noon. I am Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan.
Have a great day. See you tomorrow.